Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of our podcast, 1000 Years of Beer, straight here out of the museum of the world's oldest brewery, Weihenstephan, here in Germany, Bavaria. As always, I welcome you, Matthias, international brand ambassador and brewer of the brewery, and to my right today, our social media or online marketing manager, Anton.
Nice, you got it right. Hello, everybody.
Not often, but sometimes.
Welcome to another episode with our, well, he's part of the crew now, I think.
Yes.
He's here for the fifth time. So welcome, Dr. Florian Lehnhardt, expert for sensory analysis for taste.
Cool. Thanks Dr. again taste. For having me.
Yeah. So how have you been? How was work at the university? How was life?
Life's good. Work is a little, it's quite a lot these days, I would say. But I'm just kind of fresh from a vacation. I went to Georgia in, not in the US, but
at the Caucasus
region. I went ski touring, mountaineering there. Was quite a nice, relaxing time, I would say. Maybe not physically relaxing, but mentally relaxing time.
That's also a big part of
going vacation.
Yes, absolutely.
Cool. But today we're not talking about being in the mountains and being on skis. We're
unfortunately,
because I know, Matthias, that would be something that you'd like.
Yeah, we should do a podcast just about mountains and skiing one day. Nothing to talk about beer. We should actually do a podcast in the Alpine region where we sit on a chalet on a hut on the outside in the sun, drinking wheat beer and talking about how beautiful it is. And that's basically it.
Can I come?
Okay. I mean, whatever.
Can you talk to my boss?
Yeah. I mean, whatever. Let's do a job vacation.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's called a workation.
Yeah. This is starting so well today. Yeah. No, but our topic today is hops and hop aromas. We've been talking a lot about different beers and how to taste them, what makes them the beers they are.
Yeah.
And today
we had a great episode about yeast and how yeast is doing on the flavor and aroma of beer. And let's go to the next aromas here.
And this is hops. So let's just set up the ground for this episode. And Flo, why don't you tell us a little bit about how does hops get into the beer and why is it in there?
Sure. So typically you would add your hops either based on oil content or alpha content. I will can explain what it is and why you do it later on. You would typically add it at the start of boiling. There are a few exceptions. You can also do mash hopping, for example, but it's kind of not. It's more or less.
90% of the hop volume is added in the industry at what boiling in the hot brew house
at least,
section.
At least. Typically you start from the wort boiling and actually until the finished fermentation, which is called dry hopping.
Which is very popular at the US, or not just US, in there. Common craft beer.
It's getting more and more common, I would say.
Section,
also the late hopping and the whirlpool, for example.
I think something we do too.
Really common, I would say. So typically, next to some technological and physical like properties that the hop gives you, for example, it gives antimicrobial stability, it gives antioxidative stability, foam stability. But what we would like to focus on today is taste, which is bittering compounds, and aroma, which is then like volatiles you can smell. So typically you have two like behaviors during wort boiling. Alpha acids that come from the hops isomerize, so they change their structure basically chemically through pH and temperature. To a more stable, more bitter like version of themselves, maybe to say. And this, I don't know, needs some time to fully like react. But that's one point. So typically bittering hops you add at the beginning and you want them to change themselves.
So hops are more or less very roughly categorized in two sections, bitter hops and flavor hops. So bitter hops are more varieties that are focused in their parameters that they have a very high alpha acid content. And flavor hops are more focused on the parameters of the oil content. So exactly. That those flavor hops has a higher hop oil content because in the oils there is the flavor. Mm-hmm. And so the normal thing would be that you're using bitter hops with a high alpha acid content to do the long boiling to get the most out of it, right?
Exactly. To have the best possible extraction and conversation rate. And then on the other hand, you know, with flavor compounds, they're volatile. If you add your really high volatile flavor hops at the beginning, you will end up losing most of your aroma compounds and flavor compounds because they are simply like volatile, and that's at least to a part what you can smell during
so
water
do
boiling.
Do the thermal influence of, sure, of water boiling, yeah, those oils are just poof and blown in the air, so you can smell them in the brew house but nothing in the beer.
Sure. Imagine if you can smell them at room temperature in your beer or even in a cold beer. And basically,
what happens then to the flavor components when you boil it up to
1 hour, for example?
Yeah.
So basically, these compounds, they don't really want to be in the beer. Especially one compound which we'll talk about in the next question, I guess. So yeah, but not to overcomplicate it now. So you have these two behaviors. So bittering compounds, you start at the beginning, and you want to isomerize them to have this nice pleasant bitterness in your beer, which is also the target then during water boiling, I guess, or one of the targets. And then on the other hand, you have aroma compounds, depending on your beer style, depending on what you want to do. You get quite some interesting aroma notes there, ranging from citrus flavors, floral, rose aromas,
tropic fruits,
So quite a lot, you can imagine. Some hop companies even go that far that they say, oh, you can have toffee-like caramel aromas from the hops, mm-hmm, which you would normally associate with malt flavors. But yeah, that's quite of a niche, I would say. Mm. So these are two things. And depending on what you want to do, if you want to, for example, brew an IPA or what, you have late hopping and you have dry hopping in the cold like areas, and
so you can bring the hop flavors, the hop oils into the wort, into the beer at the brew house while boiling, but you need to keep that time very short because otherwise you would get them out of the beer. But you can also do it in the whirlpool and also in the cold section. So how do on this different levels those components extract to the product?
It's a good question because so if you stay with like natural hops or pellets, those compounds are somehow embedded in a plant structure, let's say. And of course you want to break this up. And then boiling is a good thing. I think everybody knows this from if you are cooking at home, for example. If you boil something, you kind of break it down more easily with the high temperatures, for example. But if you just have this in a really, really cold environment, everything is basically a lot slower, a lot less like effective.
So the hot extraction in the brew house is super fast.
Would be super fast, yeah. But you lose most of it. Mm-hmm. And in the cold section, you would have it like quite slow. But you have one really good advantage, which you don't have in the like only liquid wort. You have ethanol in your beer. Ethanol is a kind of a organic solvent, and most, if not all, compounds tend to dissolve better in the ethanol, so the organic part. And yeah, it's a good thing there.
So which chemical compounds are tasting how? So we said, okay, the iso alpha acids, mm-hmm, are tasting bitter.
Yeah.
and recreate them by boiling the hop as long as possible. Mm-hmm. So we change the chemical structure of the acids from the alpha acids to iso-alpha acids, and those iso-alpha acids are recognized by the human sense as bitter.
Exactly.
Is there not a bitter component in the hops, or is it more likely just the alpha acids?
So depending on who you ask, people would tell you hop is alpha acid and beer is iso-alpha acid, but of course it's a lot more complicated.
Okay.
So even with this, just the alpha acid, there's not one alpha acid, there's several alpha acids,
okay,
depending on different branches, let's say. But usually in a brewery, you talk about it as one,
okay,
global, it's compound. It's
a global compound.
Exactly.
But okay.
So, and then also you don't have... Yeah, you also have a lot more like reduced products, for example, mm-hmm, and further like transformed compounds, like say, so tetrahexahops, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to ask another question about the alpha acids. When you talk about that, there are several alpha acids. The brewer doesn't care, right? They no. just cares about the whole volume of the alpha acids combined, and this is how you measure how much hops you need for your beer, right?
Exactly. So if you would give me your hop sample today, I could take it to the lab and have a like result in a few hours, let's say, how much alpha acid content there is. It's a sum parameter, for example, and you don't care if there's one carb or more or one less. So the branching is a little different because in that analysis that you do, it simply doesn't.
Okay, so the brewer says that... the brewer does not say, well, we need 3 kilograms of hops, but we need a certain amount of alpha acids for this beer.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so it could be, in a good year, it could be 2.5 kilograms of hops to have the amount of aroma you want or the amount of bitterness you want. And in a bad year, when the hop harvest wasn't that good with not as many alpha acids as you want, it could be like 3.5 kilograms.
For example, yeah. So, okay.
So just to give you guys...
Easily range from, I don't know... 13% to 15%, which is already
okay,
a lot.
Yeah. So just to give you guys out there an idea that the brewer does not measure the hops in kilograms, but in alpha acid content.
Or on the other hand, if you have a high, like if you only dose aroma, like in the late section or cold section, then you alpha isn't actually what you want to get. So no bitterings, but you do it because you want to get flavor and aroma, and then. You could also add the hop, or add according to the hop oil content, or also to the linalool compound like concentration, and which is probably the most interesting or most recognized compound in hops and hops aroma is linalool. It's a citrus, fruity, and floral compound, and I think for probably 70% to 80% of the beer styles, it gives quite a good of picture of how fruity, hoppy your beer is. Yet,
which other components do we have in the flavor section? So, like you talked about linalool, mm-hmm. and which other do we have? We have some terpenes or.
So you have terpenes, which is basically just 10 carbon atoms formed in one molecule. Probably the most interesting one is myrcene. It's kind of this, herbal
like a mix of different herbs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's always a little like abstract and hard to describe, but herbal probably fits the best. So herbal component, and due to the fact that it's not really soluble in your beer, it really wants to go out. So that's one of the first changes also during aging, for example, that your myrcene kind of
so goes the myrcene out. Is very sensitive in the beer.
Exactly.
So it's not very stable in the matrix of beer and. Okay.
Absolutely. It's quite volatile and it doesn't want to be in the beer actually. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you have a 2 months old beer, for example, you would find most of your myrcene in your crown cork liner actually. So you can really kind of get it out there if you.
So
if
it's
you
really not in the liquid anymore.
No, no, wants to go out. So that's terpenes. Then there are terpene alcohols, which is kind of, you know, the same structure but only a little change. This alcohol and oxygen in the molecule makes it more like soluble in water and also in ethanol, for example. And that's linalool, for example, is one compound, or geraniol, for example. And they all have these fruity, floral, rosy components, I would say.
How are they? Are they pretty stable in the beer?
Yeah, quite stable, I would say. So linalool is quite stable. Other components tend to kind of inverse themselves and produce other ones. They also can undergo like esterification with acetic acid, for example. Then you have geraniol acetate from geraniol, for example. And yeah, this is also a kind of a fruity floral compound. And so in that case, it's not too bad. Mm-hmm. So let's say they're, or let's agree on, they are quite stable. In contrast to other ones, for example, so you have sulfur-containing compounds. They can have this garlic or onion-like flavors. But also thiols are there, and probably everybody has heard about thiols in that case. They are all over the U.S., like, craft beer market. If you kind of read about it, they are all over there. So basically these are three components, they smell like tropical fruity, usually it's this maracuya or ripes and berry flavors, mm-hmm. Passion fruit obviously, but depending on the concentration they can also like be quite unpleasant, let's say, and cat pee. It's one of the descriptors there.
So they can be very positive, but can also be very unpleasant.
It's a fine line. Depends on the taster, on mm-hmm. how your receptors work and everything, how it's lined up, and also on the concentration. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, the US market and also the US, even the US yeast industry is all about having thiols and thiol releasing capacity mm-hmm. in the yeast. And obviously also that helps.
So there's a huge bandwidth on different flavor components you can get into the beer by hops. I guess that's also the reason why the US craft beer scene is so hop focused,
sure.
Because a lot of beers from the United States, or also from other hop markets, are craft beer markets are very hop focused, hop orientated. I mean, look at New England IPA as an example for styles. It's like fruit juice, but great beers I had on the New England IPA side. So that's very amazing, but I guess this is also something to do with the accessibility. I mean, I guess every beer or every beer culture, beer scene has its origin in where it comes from. I mean, the beers here in Bavaria, they are we call it with classic hops. So the flavors that are generated here by the classic German varieties are more like like herbal, like flowery or rose, but very subtle and not so super intense. And like Yakima Valley or US hops, they're like
fruit bombs.
Yeah, they have like this passion fruit, maracuya. You have with Cascade and Citra. I mean Citra, even the name of the variety says everything. Yeah, of Citra citrus flavors, and this is something to do with the soil and the climate where the hop is growing. So there's a different soil there in the states of Washington or Wyoming or where the big hop fields are. The climate is very different. It's very, kind of dry, but also very hot, not all warm and sunny. So like here in the Hallertau, which is right north of the brewery. So we used to have here climate in the summer, which is good for hop growing because we have a lot of rain and that's very good because hop is a plant that needs a lot of water, but not that much on sunshine or on hot or warm weather, like compared to the US. And what I know about hop growing is that the warmer and the more sunshine you have, the more the hop tends to be more on the flavor fruity side. Yeah. But on the other side, there is not that much, you know, rain in those states, and so they have artificial watering of the whole farms, and so they can create very fruity flavor hops in high concentrates, which the German industry never had or doesn't have because of the climate and the soil. Yeah? Also, the Czech Republic hops are very different. Also, in North Germany or in the UK, the hops are very, very different, yeah? Because they have different climate and different soil to grow there. And this inflects directly the culture of the beers that are brewed there. So if you take a Bavarian Pilsner, a Czech Pilsner, and a North German Pilsner, these are all Pilsners, but very, very different, especially when it comes to the bitterness and to the hop flavor. And so also the possibility of the US grown hops has a big influence on the US craft beer scene, and with that on the worldwide craft beer scene, because they have the accessibility to great fruity hops like Citra and Amarillo and what they are called, and so it's very naturally development, I would say, to make beers like that, like an IPA, like a New England IPA or something like that. Sure. So that's what I think, which is just logic. And we will do another episode on just hop growing and growing conditions and what the hop plant is and which weather and which conditions are like influencing how the hop parameters are and how to create a new variety. I'm pretty sure we're going to find some experts on that topic. But yeah, this is something which then influences not just the beer culture, also of course the beer taste and how all this develops. And that's why the German styles are so much different than maybe US styles of beers or wherever you brew them. Yeah. So we heard about the different aspects, flavor, bitterness, how they come into the beer. If they want to be or stay in the beer or not, that's also a very huge topic and issue. So it was also part of your PhD work of the aging of lager beers. And lager beers are beers that tend to be more based on hop flavor than maybe on yeast flavor or yeast-created flavor components. So what's about that? So how do hops age in beer? That's a tricky one, right?
So I think the key is to understand that everything is dynamic and more or less changing all the time. From, I don't know, from the soil to the finished, to the glass actually. So it always undergoes changes. So what we talked about is the myrcene, it kind of goes down. So these herbal aspects of the aroma, they are actually, yeah, I don't know, they go away quite fast. Other components, they are quite stable. So these alcohols we talked about, the floral, fruity ones, they are quite stable. They can undergo some modification and changes, but with them, the flavor profile doesn't change too much. So that's not that big of a concern. But what is quite a big concern is reactive components. And for example, ethyls I talked about, they are really, really, really extremely reactive, and also they undergo quite fast changes. So the aromas, the hop-derived aromas, they undergo quite big changes.
So the reactivity is based on oxygen intake in the beer?
Also, yeah, sure.
Okay, so that's what the brewer can do. So that they take care of a minimum of oxygen intake while the production and while filling, of course. That's the biggest weak spot on that. So, and if the brewer has done its best to do prevent this, what can the consumer do to conserve the flavor or to do the best for the hop flavor in the beer?
So the best is as always, keep it cold and dark in a dark place and drink it as fast as you can.
That's good.
You had me drink advice. As fast as you can.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good advice.
But enjoy it as well. Yeah, obviously drink responsibly and everything.
Yeah, because the hop flavors are so sensitive in the beer and so volatile, right?
Yeah.
Because it changes then the character of the beer from 1 month to the other.
Sure. And if I'm a consumer, I want to have my beer or my product in a quite stable way.
Yeah,
I would
of course.
Say. So if I have it today and tomorrow and in 1 month, as you say, it should taste more or less.
I mean, that's the upside for us as a very export-oriented brewery, that's the upside on, you know, making the main business with Bavarian-style wheat beers, because there the main flavor compounds are based on the yeast, so as reactions or as compounds that the yeast is creating while the fermentation, so they are much more stable, embedded in the matrix of beer, and so the flavor and the intensity and the balance of the flavor is much more stable than as a hop component. Mm-hmm. As you already mentioned, like with myrcene, which is so volatile that actually doesn't want to be in beer. But when it comes to like the isomyl acetate or like the 4-RVG, so like the cloves and banana flavor of the typical wheat beers, lead components, they kind of want to be in the beer, so they're much stable. So we have very good experience on that to keep them in the beer and keep the beer on the same fresh or tasting balance level than we have it here in the brewery than in our export markets. But I know from breweries in the US that export that they keep their containers and trucks cooled. To conserve the hop flavor. So as the importer, they need to take care to bring the beer in the cool chain to the market, which is, when it comes to the cost side. Quite intense. But yeah, I mean, it guarantees you the origin flavor.
But it's also the reason why you don't see a lot of craft beers shipped around the world, and only the big companies can do it because they can afford to do it.
Yeah, because price sensitivity is always an issue in different beer markets, and
of course.
So this is something really challenging, of course.
Sure.
On the other side, when you have like a nice lager beer, like a Bavarian style Helles, like our original, which there is of course a little bit more hops in there than in a wheat beer. But also does not play that huge role on aging, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because like myrcene
in this kind of beer styles, you don't have too much. You basically have no thials, I would say. And if you have, or you have only a quite low hop aroma, I would say, and most
it's
of
small,
that
little
is
a bit malt based.
Yeah, sure. Kind of this. All of how would you say that? Kind of everything, but in low, but in the right concentration.
So a little bit everything there, but they're a little bit low key.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So quite subtle aroma, which is hard to describe actually, and which is quite a fine tuned mixture, I would say. But the hop side, it's more of these alcohols that determine what's going on. And as we said, those are quite stable. Therefore, the hop side doesn't change too much, but the malt side does, and also the yeast side also does a little, let's say.
Okay, folks, if you get a beer, doesn't matter which beer it is, bring it home as fast as you can, put it in your fridge and keep it cool and dark and drink it as fast as possible. That's the learning.
Exactly. Otherwise, we have to explain a lot more, and that's, as you see, it's quite.
But how can the customer, the consumer at home, how can the hobby brewer, how can the beer enthusiast, on your perspective, judge on the quality of the bitterness, on the quality of the hops in a beer? So, there are some tips and tricks you can give them to say about the quality of it.
So on the one hand, it helps if you get the really, really fresh product from your local brewery and really get to know it, see how the flavor and also the bitter profile is. But a good indication, if you don't know the fresh beer, let's say, if you talk about lager beers, IPAs, for example, and these kind of styles, they are quite, they also follow the same rules, of course, but they are a little harder to like distinguish or describe. But if you stick with lager beers, you want this harmonic bitterness, let's say, which is basically like slowly or kind of slowly ascending to a maximum, like of the intensity of the bitterness. But it should also go away quite fast, I would say. So if you have a impression, sensory impression that stays a long time and you kind of have a itching or harsh like sensation there, that shouldn't be there.
Kind of scratchy in the throat.
Exactly.
Because yeah. Mostly the bitterness you just can quality check on when you're drinking a sip the beer down, because like it's mostly in the like aftertaste of yeah. the beer where you can check out the quality, right?
Yeah,
most
that's
likely.
What when you taste beer, that's what I don't know. It's in the rule book. Let's say
in the rule book, in the playbook of drinking
yeah.
beer.
Exactly.
You drink always it. Drink it.
And then on the aroma side, it's mostly associated with the absence of things, so absence of herbal impressions, also floral impressions, and then red berries. But the presence of red berries, that's also a good indication.
So if you're like expecting some herbal or flowery notes, mm-hmm. they are quite low or not there, and more yeah. a little bit of red berries, then it's like a little yeah. bit over.
Exactly.
Is it it's a little hard for me to judge whether which one is easier to determine for an amateur, mm-hmm. basically, mm-hmm. because if you have some kind of sensory training, of course you will realize okay, this shifts now to red berry or this is the absence of herbal flavors, but I think it's easier for an amateur to determine whether the bitterness lingers on mm-hmm. than it is to actually.
Describe
the aromas and to point out what's missing.
I think so too. And also the harsh and lingering bitterness somehow gets quite exhausting if you drink a long time. And it's quite of unpleasant and doesn't make you feel that good as a fresh lager would do.
Yeah, so that is why I think that people who don't have any kind of sensory training might mm-hmm. be able to find out easier if the bitterness has a problem yeah. than...
The bitterness is I guess more recognizable. Yeah, a very good indicator. And they taught us drinkability. Drinkability is the non plus ultra when it comes to quality, or like not just quality, but also the aspect of having a good beer, because that means people like to drink it more and more. And this has a lot to do also with the bitterness. So if the bitterness, you have taken your sip, and the bitterness is still there, and it's there, and then you're not. Why you should have another sip when you still feel the bitterness and it's kind of harsh or unpleasant in your throat?
It's a fine line also. Yeah, if you drink too little bitterness, for example.
Yeah,
it's
and
not
if it's a too less,
enough,
yeah, and then it's not interesting. Right, 100% correct. So if you drink it and then you feel the bitterness is going up, bam, it's gone, mm-hmm. and then you're like. Oh, I like that. I need to drink another zip. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is what the definition of drinkability is. That you like this
constant stimulus that you want.
Yeah, and then but that's why it's important for the bitterness to go away fast so that they take the second sip. Yeah. But if this bitterness stays because of aging, of oxidation or of too old beer or not well made beer, then you're like
So in aging or in sensory, we usually call this or talk about that not necessarily the intensity of the bitterness, but the quality
of the bitterness
decreases like constantly through aging.
Because the older the beer gets, also the more intense the bitterness gets, but not the quality gets better.
Can also be that it decreases. So usually you have a short increase, that is, you have this harsh bitterness, mm-hmm. and then you have a decrease. Usually it's oxidation of your bitter components, and at some point they are still sensory effective, and if you oxidize it more, they change even more, and then at some point they are not active anymore.
Okay. Well, very interesting and always very enlightening for me, because I'm not a very chemical person.
I mean, if it's enlightening for you, my mind is blown. So
yeah, that was always my big problem in the brewing school, you know, all the chemical tests and all the chemical courses. In the German episode, Florian and me, we talked about when I had this one test on hops and beer, the Watt test. I need to write down like the chemical structures of alpha acid and how it became then the isomeric version of it, the isoalpha acid. Guess who's done it wrong? Yeah, it's... was me, obviously. And now I'm doing a podcast with a chemistrist who is perfect in that. So you don't need to know it on yourself. You need to know someone who knows it. So you're my guy. You're my cool. My chemical guy. So everyone has guys for everything. Yeah. Like, you know, I have that guy and that
the
guy.
Alpha acid guy.
You're my chemical guy. So if I have in my life chemical questions, you're the guy I go to.
Sure, yeah? Cool.
Yeah.
Last but not yeast.
Wow. yeah, last but not yeast.
It just
yeast.
Came to me and I had to do it. I had to do it.
Wow. Did you come up with it?
Yeah. Yeah, because now we're coming to our community corner. And cool. This is a very nice introduction to it, especially to the topic of the question. But I'm still in awe, Anton. I'm still in awe. Wow. Oh, this joke really makes me feel physical pain.
100% you're going to use it in the US in the next few weeks.
Even I'm going to use it.
God, that's so stupid. Okay, because we got a very nice and great email from Ray. Ray is at home in Japan, in Nagano. And he reached out to us, and he seems to be a very, very... big fan of the podcast, and he's also very into the topics and the things we're talking about. And he wrote us an very interesting email, and he was referring to one of our episodes where we talked about wheat beers and categorizing wheat beers, and especially from Professor Buck, who was when he was in charge here of the Brewing Institute in Weihenstephan. And his scientific work on his institute, they defined four kind of wheat beer flavors, four profiles. It's the esteric, the ester profile, which is the fruity one, then the phenolic, which is the spicy or the one cloves. With cloves, cloves, and then the neutral wheat beers and the yeasty wheat beers. And he's referring in those four categories to the yeasty wheat beer, and that he thinks that Professor Buck's yeasty classification is a little underdeveloped, as he's writing us. And he's asking, is the yeasty Weissbier category just an euphemism for old, past-date, stale, and or autolytic Weissbier? Or is it a valid flavor target for excellent Weissbier? His interpretation is that there is only three categories, the phenolic, the estery, and the neutral ones. The fourth category, the yeasty, seems to originate more like from the neutral one and descends sometimes into the yeasty one. So very interesting opinion here and very good question. So Ray, thank you very much for this. We really loved this email, and we wanted to wait to answer that in our community corner when we have the expert for that here, and that's obviously Florian. And let's talk a little bit about that, what Ray was pointing here out.
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. And it's I have to be fair, it's really sophisticated, and probably it has a lot of layers. And I think it will take some time to...
Yeah, of course. We will take the time.
Talk about it. So at first, I wouldn't say it's underdeveloped. And that's because of the reason... I think Professor Buck doesn't state in his categories that there are only four categories existing, but he picks it out in his sensory scheme. because it's more or less the representation of the kind of research area at that time in Germany, let's say. Mm-hmm. So at that time you would also have more like yeasty wheat beers, for obviously.
And those were the four lead directions.
At that time, yeah. Mm. Obviously now it changed a little, I would say. So you would find less like straight yeasty ones. You would also find less straight ones. Phenolic ones. I think there are quite some neutral ones, but the S3 ones, okay.
They dominate
the market, yeah. Sure. So you have this shift of consumer expectation, I think, also there.
I guess it's also something to do with technology, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
You want to talk about it?
Maybe later.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be then going very deep, but yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And I think we also had it on the episode a little.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe go back and listen to the episode again. Could be a cool refreshment, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one point. Or it's actually two points.
So this is at that time, Professor Buck did the research on that.
Yeah.
Those four directions
they made a
were
sense.
Valid directions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Maybe now it's the picture changed
because
a little.
Because I can say in the last 10 years I was drinking wheat beers, I basically never had a yeasty one.
Yeah maybe. Yeah.
I would say today in Germany they are nearly died out. I could not tell you an example for one, but also maybe I'm doing a misinterpretation on how they do, because you
that's
also said
point,
they're
yeah.
very close to estery ones when it comes to the sensorial.
So the term yeasty, I think, could be further like categorized. So you have this fresh yeasty ones,
mm-hmm.
and that's what Professor Bock is referring to and the research at that time. And that's quite a subtle aroma. So you have a little bit of higher alcohols, a little bit of esters, like acetaldehyde, or these faint fruity notes. That
like in a fresh fermentation?
Like in a
so
salad.
If you're a hobby brewer, then you would say there's like third, fourth, fifth day of fermentation, like those smell you will have in your...
Absolutely. And if you have active yeast in your product, you have these components.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, so that would be positive.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, you have like old yeasty or stale, whatever yeasty. And that's exactly how Ray kind of describes it, autolysis.
Mm-hmm.
So you have compounds you wouldn't actually want to have in your beer. And that's exactly, or predominantly, it's sulfury compounds that have a like kind of, say, bad aroma, or not to go deeper in that, and like some acids, they have this goaty and cheesy and kind of sweaty aromas, and that's obviously something you don't want. So that would be the old yeasty ones. Yeah, and then I don't know, there are a lot of more different layers, but I think the question is really, really sophisticated and deep, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, back to Ray, thank you for that. I also think that the yeasty wheat beers are not that popular anymore, not just because the trend tends to be to go more to the estery or neutral or phenolic ones. Especially like those mixed types between estery and phenolic notes, you know, those are very favorite, very popular actually, and also the Weinstephan is a typical example for that
perfect
we cannot
example,
be classified
yeah.
for a phenolic one. We can also not be classified for an estery one. We are basically,
and of course not a neutral malty one.
Definitely not. So we are definitely a mixed type of those two categories. But I would say also the risk of a yeasty wheat beer, where the fresh flavor is pleasant, but then when it comes to aging and you have autolysis and then getting a very unpleasant flavor, I assume that this was the main reason why you don't find much of those yeasty wheat beers anymore, because for any brewery the risk is when the beer gets sold in the shelf or at the restaurant or whatever, then the people don't drink my wheat beer anymore, because if they have once or twice a bad experience on the taste, they will never go back to the brand.
Absolutely.
So that's why they maybe shift their production idea or with the trend to a more estery one or
sure.
whatever, because the autolysis risk is when you work on that kind of yeasty wheat beer is very high.
Yeah. So actually, what we discussed on the hops as well. So you don't want to have the most intensive aroma or intense aroma. You want to have a interesting, nice,
stable beer.
Stable mm-hmm. beer, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So Ray, to sum it up, it's very complex questions with many layers, but I think the four categories are still valid, especially when it comes to a perspective of classification and a sensory analysis of different wheat beers.
But so you could easily kind of enlarge the categories for yeah. balanced or hoppy or whatever.
Yes, and or also putting mixed type into it. Exactly. And on the other side, we need to say that maybe the yeasty type is endangered category because it's
consumer
not
focus shifted.
Yeah, consumer focus, yeah. And that's why they're not that much anymore there. Has something to do with technology because in the older days, wheat beers were mainly made by bottle conditioning, and then there were more types of cause of that technology on yeasty wheat beers because when they used fresh yeast and did not inactivate the yeast because they were just selling it around the brewery, then it was maybe more common to have that kind of wheat beers today. The technology evolved, you're doing more time, short time pasteurization on that, so the autolytic risk is also done. And then maybe also with that, the style shifts more to an estuary one wheat beer than being recognized as a yeasty.
So a lot of influences and a lot of factors.
Yeah, but a great question. Really cool, yeah. Appreciate that you sent it over. I hope you have some...
more questions.
More questions for us, but also you enjoy maybe some good local beers and some Weihenstephan beers in Japan. I read just this last week that the container of our new Braupakt just landed also in Japan. So Japan nice. Is one of our top five countries where we are sending out the Braupakt, our collaboration brew with St. Bernardus from Belgium. Mm-hmm. So Ray, maybe keep your eyes open and you get some Braupakt also in Japan. But yes, thank you. Thanks for your time, Florian, for this episode.
Thank you.
If you have questions, people, send it to us.
podcast@weinstefana.de or through one of our social media channels.
Please send us your questions, your feedback, what you like. If you don't like it, then don't let us know. Actually, that's an information we can skip. No, we would really love to have your feedback here on the show. And if you have questions, let us know. We will discuss it in one of the next episodes. So keep tuning in and tell your friends about it. Have a good time. Have a good beer. And bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye.